Welcome back to Booked Up. This is Jen Taub, and today I'm speaking with my friend, Linda Charnas, who happens to be a professor of English, European Studies, and Gender Studies at Indiana University at Bloomington. We covered a lot of ground. We talked about Hamlet, Pollyannic law, and America's revenge fantasies. We also talked about the hallmarks of Gothic literature, including the attempt to evade a past that refuses to remain silent. The focus of our conversation is Hamlet's Heirs, Shakespeare and the Politics of a New Millennium, a collection of essays that she wrote 20 years ago, but still remain relevant. Let's dive right in. Hey, good to see you.
How are you?
I'm good. It's weird seeing you in the daytime.
Yeah. Well, except for the clutch you took from me.
Oh, I forgot about that so soon. It's been,
you make it sound like I'm a vampire.
I mean, like, yeah. There's nothing wrong with that, though.
No,
I mean, if you were a vampire, would you drink blood, or what would be your drink of choice?
That's a tough one. You know, given that I have these, these snaggle teeth fangs anyway, what would I drink if I were a vampire? I'm going to have to get back to you on that because
okay,
it would be
time.
A whole totally different ontology, totally different worldview.
I know you didn't ask me about that, but I'm thinking I am much more of a savory type. So, I mean, I don't want to drink blood because I am, of course, almost a vegan. Definitely a vegetarian.
Yes.
And, you know, also they never say, I mean, vampires, they say blood and the presumption is it's human blood, but it could be other kinds.
It has to be human blood. I mean, if we're going to go by the history of the lore, right?
Oh.
Vampire lore, the history of Gothic vampire lore.
About that.
Well, okay. You know, if you start with Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is, you know, where our, at least that's the origin of our lore. And now we're going into lit mode, which I love because you and I have spent so much time talking about literature, you know, just in our regular Zoom chats. But, you know, Bram Stoker in the late 19th century wrote Dracula.
Okay.
And that's where, you know, that novel really kind of inaugurated vampiredom into the realm of Gothic literature, which had already been around for maybe 100, 150 years. You know, I've written about that.
Wait, what had been around for 150? The vampiredom or
no,
the Gothic,
Gothic
literature?
Gothic.
Okay,
Gothic
got you.
Literature. Yeah, Gothic literature. But Bram Stoker wrote, you know, during the Victorian era, the late Victorian era, and industrial London, that's pretty much where that's the roots for our vampire fetish, right?
I know that we're talking about the Victorian era. We're going to get to the Elizabethan. And what is it about these women rulers that bring out the best in literature? But go back to, what do you mean by Gothic? How would you define Gothic literature? What are the emblematic aspects? And then why the vampire?
Oh, well, you know what? I love that question because I published something in 2010 on Shakespeare and the Gothic. And so the kind of the attributes of what's considered to be Gothic, it's usually attributed to have started with Horace Walpole, the Castle of Otranto. But I argue it starts earlier, of course, with Hamlet. Jen.
How did you do that? We're supposed to be talking about Hamlet today, and you just tucked it right in there.
Yeah, that's what I published. A Shakespeare in the Gothic Strain. That's the name of the piece.
I always forget the titles.
Sorry?
So tell me, that was from 2010. Tell me about it, if you remember.
Yeah, I do remember. I'm trying to think of all the things that I listed off as being key to the Gothic. But It usually began, and what I did was I kind of set up, what was that HBO thing set in Louisiana?
HBO Louisiana.
Yeah, with the vampires.
Anne Rice? Anne Rice's books?
Anne Rice's thing. That thing. No, not her novel. True Blood. True Blood. Okay. True Blood.
Sorry.
And, you know, like 10 years ago, our culture was totally sunk in the vampire fetish, right? Mm-hmm. Everything was vampire. Now it's zombies. Now it's The Walking Dead.
It was those series, that children's, the teen series about the vampires. And I think I read one of them and I'm forgetting what it's like a metaphor for premarital sex or something. Those vampire teen books. What were they called?
I can't remember those, but
anyway,
the way that vampires.
The Twilight series.
Yeah. Right.
Go back to your thing. Sorry.
Okay. Well, the hallmarks of the Gothic. Uh-huh. Old intergenerational crumbling estates and architecture in deep old aristocratic architecture in deep disrepair.
Okay.
And then, oh gosh, I wish I'd known I was going to talk about this. I would have pulled up my essay, but this is better because it just forces me to reconnect those neurons. The way that I specifically defined the Gothic in my mm-hmm. piece was that something can't be Gothic unless it involves a deep, hidden, and shameful family secret. And of course, this corresponds to Edgar Allan Poe's emergence as a writer in America, right? I also said that, you know, the way that I would conjure a sense of the Gothic is something buried beneath the floorboards that keeps issuing audible but indecipherable demands. Okay, so whether it's the telltale heart,
right,
banging on the floorboards. And, you know this from countless, from the Babadook to countless haunted house stories. So the Gothic is...
And the mad woman in the attic and everything about this sort of...
The attic, I mean, Jane Eyre. Yeah. So, you know, the Gothic is very much about an attempt to evade a past.
Uh-huh.
That refuses to be silenced. When I wrote about this, I argued that I thought that Ophelia was the first Gothic heroine. So I didn't subscribe to, the Walpolean genealogy, but I'm weird that way. Anyway.
So Ophelia, Hamlet, that brings me to why. I tricked you. I didn't mean to start talking about vampires,
but you introduced that. And it'll always be better if I'm unprepared. Always.
I'm going to keep that in mind. I won't tell my students that, though. I like when they're prepared. But your book, I have a confession to make, which is when we met, I wanted to read your work. And so a couple years ago, I ordered my copy of Hamlet's Heirs. I just went back and checked to see when it was. It was like August of 2020. But I maybe quickly looked at the intro, but the spine wasn't even broken into this week. So I really, confession,
okay.
I tell you. This gave me, knowing that I was going to speak with you, gave me a chance to make the excuse to read it. And I forgot how much I love literary criticism, especially the kind of different... the different schools of but different interpretive methodologies and the fights over that. It dawned on me because I knew we were going to be speaking that the title heir might be a pun.
Yeah.
In other words, you use the word heirs to mean like survivor, someone who inherits a legacy. But I also think the word heir sounds like error, like a mistake. Was that intentional? Was it Hamlet's errors or are we his heirs or both?
No, I love that question. It wasn't intentional. My editor, the editor of that book, said he first wanted to call it Hamlet's Hairs, H-A-I-R-S.
And that's so I funny. Said, Michael was saying that's what it was called last night because, you know, he's always, you know, Michael. I mean, sorry to cut you off. But
of course I know, Michael. You know I know.
You wanted, your editor wanted to do something so silly, though. What's that about?
Terrence Hawks, famous, brilliant, now late editor. But he called it Omelets Hairs. He just, every time we corresponded about it, he would play with it. But I called it Hamlet's Heirs, H-A-H-E-I-R-S, because Hamlet doesn't have any heirs at the end of the play.
He doesn't have any heirs. Oh, right.
And so, as you know, from my argument in at least several of the chapters, you know, Hamlet's death is the death of the state, it's the end of Denmark. Right? Fortinbras of Norway comes in with his troops and, you know, Hamlet has not reproduced. So I wanted to think about who are Hamlet's heirs, given that Hamlet dies without having married, without having had children, without having had offspring. And yet he himself as a figure, as a literary figure, is the most famous heir, not heir, in literary history, right? Firstborn mm-hmm. son, namesake of a king who was murdered, right? Well, King mm-hmm. Hamlet murdered. Prince Hamlet doesn't have any siblings, and yet he doesn't inherit the throne. So something's going wrong with succession. I write about that, as you know, because you've now read the thing. Oh my gosh, is that up there on your bookshelf?
You know, when the book first came in the mail, I'm like, why is it so cloudy? And then I realized that's a ghost on the cover.
Yes.
I didn't know on the black. It was a ghost.
Well, is that a paperback or a hardcover?
It's a paperback.
And it's black?
Well, so it's kind of, I wish you could feel it. It feels kind of like a velvety thing, but it's a paperback.
Okay.
And then it's the top half with the title is like a gray, and then there's, you know, your name, and then below, like two-thirds of it is black, but I feel like I see, it might be the ghost of, I don't know who this is. It might be Hamlet Sr. I can't quite tell, or maybe this is a coffee stain. I don't know.
It's not a coffee stain. In the original paperback, and you know, this is the hardcover.
You mean hardcover? Oh, no, the hardcover's not even black. I see.
Well, no, the hardcover was for university libraries and college libraries.
Oh, where they gouge them with the price. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah,
the price
exactly.
is higher. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, the hardcover, and this they sent me this when they reissued the hardcover in 2016, which surprised me because it meant a lot of libraries were reordering it. But the paperback, my paperback, was sort of a pink and purple with the ghost there. So, you know, I don't know. I don't have any control over what they do around that. But the idea of something going wrong with the process of succession. Mm-hmm. And not that there's anything wrong with that in general, but, you know, Shakespeare's writing this, and in Shakespeare's day, succession is.
Can we just do this one thing? Let's just sort of back up. Cause I mean, I know we know
what we can do.
Back up with Hamlet. No. So if we're just to kind of back up, I just want to make sure I have this right.
Okay.
Hamlet was written around 1599. Ish, like in other words,
1600 ish. Yeah, was
okay.
Right at the turn.
So Elizabeth is still alive. James is not the king.
Right.
And what I learned from taking your class last spring, and I hope I get the name of this, it was Shakespeare and Political Spectacle or something like that.
That's it. That's exactly right.
Yep. So I start to think a lot more about, like, when I was rereading Hamlet. For this, I was thinking a lot, and reading your essays, I was thinking a lot more about the context in which this play was performed and what the audience would have been thinking about in terms of their own political milieu, like what was going on with Elizabeth. But also that was fascinating me was that what was going on in Denmark, as well in terms of the way they supposedly had elections, but it was really still primogeniture. Okay.
Okay.
So
good.
I guess I want to back, I did read, but I guess I want to back up because you talk about the trouble with, you know, this kind of ties into the Gothic thing, but you back up with, you talk just now about problems with succession, and Hamlet doesn't really have the normal expected entitled literally succession. So what was this play? Two things, I guess. And I'm wondering what the, was this one of these plays where people were, was this a radical play, and was Elizabeth pissed off? Was this a challenge to monarchy, or was this a celebration of monarchy because Hamlet's robbed of monarchy? Like, I'm wondering what this play, if you were a Queen Elizabeth at the time, or you were her courtiers, would you have been insulted, encouraged, or how would you have taken this play, given that at the end of the day, Denmark is lost?
Yes,
you know, what is that saying? It's not a great thing if you have a monarchy to think it would be, you know, are they identifying with Hamlet, or Fortinbras comes in and wins, you know, and again, he had his own legacy issue. Anyways, I'm just kind of throwing, I'm just throwing stuff out in terms of the political story here.
Yeah. And you know what? This is exactly why I so loved having you in that seminar last spring, because this is a series of really difficult questions. You know, is monarchy a good thing? Is monarchy not a good thing? And you're asking that from the context of the issues that we talked about in the seminar, which is about how, you know, and I tried to claim, at least, you know, not too heavy-handedly, but that Shakespeare himself raised serious issues about, you know, the grounds of sovereignty. And what it means to, you know, there are serious problems with entitlement. So let's just start out by saying that. Entitlement is not in and of itself a good thing. And furthermore, it's often a bad thing. And, you know, Thomas Paine was the one who drove the nails into the coffin of that in Common Sense, right? When the colonies decided to separate, to declare independence from the king. But your
question, what year was that again? What year was Thomas Paine?
That was Thomas Paine published his first edition of Common Sense in January of 1776.
Okay, got it. I'm just trying to time frame it. Okay, go back.
Think about that. January 1776.
Yeah.
The Declaration of Independence was published on July 4th, 1776.
That date rings a bell.
We'll get there.
But you're saying this is six. This play is written 175 plus years before, and you're saying about problems with entitlement.
It absolutely, and in fact, in every Shakespeare political play and history play, this question of who should be in charge and what should the grounds be. You know, the grounds legally are, you know, hereditary succession, patriarchal primogeniture.
Right.
And, you know, we talked about the Henriad, and we talked about Richard II and then Queen Elizabeth on the throne, and Queen Elizabeth designating her nephew, James VI of Scotland, to be James I of England upon her death. The doctrine of divine right of kings held that, the bloodline. It was the bloodline that conferred legitimacy.
Right.
Okay. Well, now I would love, thinking about this now, I'd like to sign off right now and go write something about bloodline legitimacy and vampires. Okay.
But that's. I was going to say that because I didn't want to distract you. Okay. But you can't keep talking to me. I'm now getting into this. I want to hear about what the audience, focus on the audience. The audience at the play. You're sitting there watching the performance of Hamlet.
So I'm going to try to put myself into, you know, kind of the kind of middling level of somebody going to see Hamlet in 1600. they don't know anything at all about, and there's been so much stuff written about Hamlet, but let me just say this from the outset. Election is not a thing. So it doesn't matter that the word election, you know, that the Danish council gave their approval to Claudius being on the throne. Hamlet, the audience there, they would have noticed a couple of things. First of all, Claudius married the late King Hamlet's widow within apparently weeks of his death. Mm-hmm. So we got something that, at least in terms of, you know, scriptural doctrine, counts as incest. The second thing is the speed of that marriage. The third thing is that...
Well, just to make the point of, I mean, am I getting this right? Claudius was the king's brother.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Okay, got it. And that's why you say incest.
He was not next in line. So if you think about patriarchal primogeniture, which is a vertical arrow that goes from the legitimate monarch to his firstborn male child. If that male child is dead, it goes to his secondborn male child. If they are both dead, it goes to his firstborn legitimate daughter. It is a vertical hierarchy. So for that throne to go, for Claudius to have taken the throne along with wedding Gertrude, I mean, at the end of Act One, when Hamlet says, you know, the time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite that ever I was born to set it right. The time is out of joint, but the question we have to ask is, how is temporality and succession, how are those things, how is the movement of progress, of political progress, of national progress and inheritance being marked by the death of kings and proper succession?
So the audience would have heard this thing about, oh, it's fine, the council approved it, and they would have called BS on that?
I believe so. I can't know for sure, Jen. Honestly,
they would have been upset by it because it's not how things
I
are
think
done,
so.
Right?
I think so. And, you know, having read, you know, the 800 million pieces of scholarship on the play, Shakespeare's audience wouldn't have known anything at all about Danish succession, or, you know, the Rigsråd, right, the Danish Council of Elders. But even if they had, the fact of the matter was, in Denmark, the monarchy went to Oldenburg heirs. So it automatically went. And the council giving their stamp of approval, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Putin saying, oh, do you approve? It's like, yeah, we approve. So
can I just ask you
Shakespeare's audience. No, I want to
yeah,
try as
good.
best as I can to answer your question, because I don't feel that I've done it yet.
Okay.
My educated guess is that Shakespeare's audience coming to see Hamlet would have immediately, even before knowing that Claudius, even before meeting the ghost, but that Claudius, that Claudius was on the throne and was married to his brother's widow, the audience would right away have understood that as something being seriously wrong. And that scenario in and of itself, for me, is Gothic. And, you know, the thing is, in Hamlet's Heirs, I wasn't writing about the Gothic. But, you know, now I've written about the Gothic, and now I would look at it differently. And so there's, you know, there's different work in the future. But I believe that Shakespeare's audience would have known there was something wrong with it. I believe that they would have been rooting. Here we can go into generic expectations about what the revenge genre is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I think Shakespeare's audience would have been waiting. Let's say they hadn't seen the play. They would have been They would have been waiting for Hamlet to kind of, you know, shark up a list of his friends, of whom apparently he has many, to take back the throne from Claudius. But that's not what happens.
Right.
And that's what's so interesting.
And that piece, I'm thinking about the audience, and of course the dramatic tension is wondering, is he, when is he, will he, take back the throne. But to me, the political story might be, if you're watching in England, given the history and given the future, that despite the fact that the way it's supposed to be through this, you know, vertical patrilinear, you know, primogeniture succession, that it doesn't just happen, that often violence is necessary and undergirds the whole process. And that Hamlet himself isn't willing, it seems like he's seeing himself as a man with normal frailties who doesn't want to take that step. And I have to say, this is the weird thing. I know we're supposed to, when I studied Hamlet and just even everything I read about Hamlet, it's always kind of like, well, what a bozo, that guy couldn't act, so hesitant. And I'm thinking, what the hell? I wouldn't want to go kill somebody. I mean, of course he hesitates. Who wants to commit murder? And so even if why does he get such a bad rap, Linda? Like, you know, what would you do? Jen, Jesus.
You know, Jen, I mean, your question is so crucial. And I think that, I mean, it's why I wrote the, well, it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, right? Everybody is always talking, and I actually did on an Amtrak train. I can't remember which chapter that was in. I can never remember. It's like most authors have hysterical forgetting. What I call hysterical forgetting of what's in their chapters.
Yes, it's healthier that way, yeah.
I believe so. I think the ones who can remember exactly where everything is, beware, okay. but, you know, the kind of thumbnail sketch in the general, to the general mind is that Hamlet is famous for being, you know, the prince who equivocates on, you know, payback for his debt, right?
Mm-hmm, right?
He equivocates, he procrastinates, he delays. And, you know, Shakespeare was way too canny and psychologically smart at that point to be doing anything so simple. And also, you know, Hamlet is the longest play that Shakespeare wrote. So how do you write the longest play of your career about someone who delays?
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of this being a problem, instead of saying, oh, that Hamlet, you know, he's just a ne'er-do-well or a slacker or, you know, whatever has been said about him, instead one needs to look at the process of delay or procrastination itself as being a meaningful, thick, rich, in a sense, Gothic text. There's something underneath. See, thank you for asking. You know, there's something underneath the floorboards of Gothicness that is pertinent to Hamlet and to that delay.
Delay. I'm going to take us on a detour, but you mentioned the word procrastination, and I feel like always liked it. And we'll get back to Hamlet, I promise.
There's no exit from Hamlet, Jen. You don't have to worry about we'll get back to Hamlet. We're never going to get away from Hamlet.
Okay. I feel that's so true. But procrastination, your floorboards, when you're writing or when you're not writing, how do you procrastinate?
Well, I think a more interesting question vis-a-vis me would be, how do I not procrastinate? But what happened with Hamlet's heirs, it was begun, I think, in 97, 90, something like that. And, you know, and then Indecision 2000 hit.
The Bush Gore.
The Bush v. Gore. And a full month. Then I carried on. Because I thought that what I was writing was accurate, but then 9/11 happened. And all of the controversies surrounding Bush's election were tabled, you know, for the nonce, as Shakespeareans would say, were tabled as the country came together and pulled together. I had to stop working on that project. You know, I had a book half finished. And so procrastinating for me, Now I'm much better at procrastinating. I mean, I can, you know, I'll repot orchids. I will do other things. But back then I felt like I had to do something really impressive to justify and really hard to justify procrastination. So I one day drove out to, there's an airfield, an airport in Bloomington, 20 minutes from my house. And I drove out and took a flying lesson. And then I signed up for a second flying lesson. And then I kept coming back.
Wait a second. Because I know that you fly, but you decided to learn how to fly after the terrorists flew planes into the Twin Towers.
Yes.
Fascinating, Linda. No.
I actually started slightly before. I took a few flying lessons. But after that happened, and there was a 4-month moratorium, I went back and continued learning to fly, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. I was having a celebratory dinner with a few fellow pilots, grown-ups who had been doing their licenses with me, and we were at a restaurant in Bloomington, and on the big screen TV, which is always in college towns, there was the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Oh, I remember. It March, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And I watched it in utter horror. I started to understand what was happening. And anyway, I had no idea how to finish my book. This goes back to your question, because remember about me, I'll never forget where your question starts.
That.
I might get back to you 2 years later. But I'll remember. I was writing about what was wrong with American politics, and then 9/11, and then 2003, and shock and awe. Mm-hmm. And I thought for sure that we would, I mean, it was so patently obvious to me that our invasion of Iraq was bogus, that it was an American revenger scenario, right, of W, for his father, right, from the 93 Gulf War. And, you know, that's Operation Enduring Hamlet. That's, you know, what W called the invasion was Operation Enduring Freedom. So,
right.
But I was sure he wouldn't be reelected. And so I thought, good, I hope not. But what it would have meant was scrapping, which I would have been more than happy to do, scrapping a couple of chapters. Because I thought the American public would be, and I hate to say this, and it sounds horrible, but I was shocked that Americans would reelect W. I was shocked by it. And, you know, after a month's worth of depression, I realized that the argument that I was making about American revengers would actually hold up. I didn't have to scrap any chapters. Mm-hmm. And I continued and I finished it. And, you know, this is the really painful thing for me about this book. I wanted to abandon it halfway through because I wanted to have been wrong about American political psychology. But I turned out not to be. But in the couple years interim, while I was waiting to see what would happen, I just felt like I had to do something with my anxiety, and I had to conquer my anxiety in some way. And I was a fearful flyer, fearful on commercial flights, fearful flyer. And I thought, well, okay, you know, you want to deal with a fear? Go learn how to fly.
Are you still a fearful flyer?
No.
If you're not flying?
Well, I'm fearful of fellow passengers.
Yeah.
Who are crazy.
When was the last time you flew yourself?
Quite a while. You mean
either one. Any kind of plane.
Well, Let's see. The last time I was piloting a single engine, and I have a private pilot's license just for single engine. So mm-hmm. it's a private pilot license. The last time I got on a commercial flight was when I went to see my dad for his 90th birthday.
It's been a while.
Well, you know, he died in the middle of the big COVID mm-hmm. thing, so I couldn't get out there. You know, but the thing about flying was that versus, and this may be interesting to the people listening, because, you know, some of your audience is going to think, gosh, you know, you had Dahlia on and you had Michael Cohen on, and who's this person here? You know,
who's this person? I think by now they're like, how can I hear more of this person? Well, you're incredible, Linda. I mean, geez.
Well, Jen, come on. You know, but you know, we are friends, and we've talked so much in depth about ideas. But you know, the thing is, going directly into what you're afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to be said for it, and when it was clear to me in 2004, when W was reelected, I knew that I didn't have to jump chapters, and so I immediately went back, revised, wrote two more chapters, and finished Hamlet's Heirs. It was a bittersweet thing.
Back into the text itself, because
which text, Hamlet?
No, your text.
My book.
Okay. So you talked about just now, you know, wondering if the country had taken a different direction, maybe you would have had to scrap things, but it didn't.
Yes.
And when I was reading it this week, there are several things I read that seemed incredibly prescient, the way in which I feel, but also prescient in a way that makes you uncomfortable. The same way that if anyone goes back and watches the film Network, it's just uncanny how quaint it seemed back then. But there's one thing in particular. You talk about 9/11 being a turning point or an inflection point. I think you might have said.
Well, people said. I talk about that. People said. I wrote that everyone in the media was saying that this changed
yes.
everything, but that I didn't buy it.
Exactly. So this is a sentence, and I felt like this sentence, you know, we had 9/11, 2001. We also had 11/9, which was the morning in 2016 when we learned Trump won. We have 1/6,
right.
All these moments that people say are inflection points. And I think that what you wrote about 9/11 could have been said about the election of Donald Trump. So here's the sentence. The events of September 11th did not change things so much as they abruptly shoved an already rough beast out of what remained in hiding. I like the Yeats reference there too. That just hits in a different way now. Do you want to comment on that, or does it speak for itself?
I do. It causes me, as you can see on my face, it causes me pain because, you know, I mean, the audience can't see it, but it causes me so much pain. I never ever thought it would get so much truer and so much worse.
Mm-hmm.
What I was talking about was a certain kind of American psychology of American revenger nationalism. That was the genre. And, you know, the same decade in which that happened was the decade of, you know, Die Hard, Die Hard 2, Lethal Weapon 2, Lethal Weapon 3, great-grandson of Lethal Weapon.
I feel like you're now starting to make things up, but I was buying that as a title.
I am, but I've also kicked off my flip-flops. Okay. Yeah, I'm in Indiana.
Oh, you're
but
in California still. I don't believe in flip-flops.
No. I'm not in California. I'm in Indiana.
But I don't like flip-flops.
Neither do I, but I'm trying to I'm trying to do the, you know, this talking with Jen about this on this podcast.
I get it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. First few days after the party. But that decade, you know, the last American, the one with Schwarzenegger, which was a Hamlet rip, that the same decade that Bush and Cheney invaded Iraq, completely misled the American public, totally missed, you know, where the problem actually was. That was the same decade that saw an explosion of refabricated and repackaged Hamlets. And so the point of Hamlet's Heirs was about how American politics had been taking this figure, had been Hamletizing the idea of revenge.
So what does that do? In other words, if you're talking about, you know, you mentioned this idea of the revenge story, and Hamlet, to the, you know, one way to read it is, look, see what happens if you don't act quickly and get revenge. Or maybe another way to read it is, revenge is fruitless because in the end, Denmark is lost. I don't know. Well, how do you see Hamlet? What do you mean by Hamletizing the American revenge story? What is the American revenge story? I mean, there are many American revenge stories.
No. Two really interesting connected questions, but two.
Pick one of them. I don't care.
It doesn't matter. I'll find a way to hit both, hopefully. Okay. What does it mean? What is the American revenge story? And that's a question with a long arc, and longer even than my book. I mean, people in film studies and, you know, the have written about this. But the idea of the angry, almost on the verge of insanity, revenger.
Right.
That, right? Because everybody says Hamlet's, you know, in the play, it's like, oh, Hamlet's, you know, Hamlet's crazy, although Polonius and Claudius can hear, no, there's a method to this madness. You know, the Hamlet is like the world's first greatest passive aggressive, right? He's saying a bunch of stuff under the cloak of, you know, having put on an antic disposition, pretending to be nuts. But what he's saying, everything has an edge that anyone who's listening can hear. And in the play, there are people listening, and they are getting a funny feeling about him. So what's it about the figure of Hamlet as a revenger, and this, I'm coming around to your question, that connects up with how America and how American politics and foreign policy was thinking about revenge in American culture during the aughts. Is it the aughts? Is that what we're calling it? The aughts? I've never been comfortable with that.
I will. But I'll accept it. I'll allow it.
Okay. Okay. It's always the lone revenger.
Right,
the rogue avenger, the person who hasn't been given his due avenger. And this is terribly problematic because in the play, in Hamlet, and I'll talk about Hamlet just for a few moments, and then we can go in any direction you want. There's no question, and I've argued it down to the mat, that, you know, it for Shakespeare's audience or for Shakespeare, it's not a question of an election. It's a question of succession. Hamlet doesn't, you know, why does Hamlet delay for so long? Mm-hmm. And this is key to what my book does. And I still believe this. I haven't changed my mind about this. And I sort of live to change my mind about pieces that I've written in the past. It's part of my hysterical forgetting of where things are and where did I see what. graduate students will ask, oh, where was that published? I'm like, I can't remember. All right. So
you argue with yourself sometimes about this.
Sometimes? Are you kidding? You should only live in my head. No.
Oh, please. It's already too crowded in mine. I don't need to get in more fights.
So there's a reason that Hamlet takes so damn long. I mean, the ghost discloses to him Claudius's crime in Act 1, Scene 5. Right? The ghost appears in Act 1, Scene. But in Act 1, Scene 5, the ghost says, you know, revenge by foul and unnatural murder. You know, and he says, 'tis given out. The rumor was, I don't have anything in front of me. I've got nothing in front of me. I moved everything away.
Were you the one
away.
Who compared this? Wait, you wrote about Bartleby the Scrivener in this context. I'd rather not. That no, okay, was I'm, so I'm good. Okay.
Did you like that? You liked
fucking
that?
Fucking loved it. Loved it.
Okay. When I made that connection, there was something about Bartleby I'd been wanting to say forever, but didn't know what it was. And when I finally got to the end of Hamlet's Errors, I understood what it was. So the thing about Hamlet, the prince, is that he's stuck. Shakespeare, and I believe Shakespeare did this intentionally. I do, because it's his longest play, and he sets everything up for succession. He lays everything out in Act One for revenge, and the genre of revenge tragedy in Shakespeare's day is already, you know, it's like when we watch a sitcom or, you know, an episode of Law and Order, we know what to expect. So the revenger tragedy would have been a common genre for Shakespeare's audience. So Shakespeare decides instead to write Hamlet. I mean, have I sworn yet? I don't think so.
You're
what
allowed.
In the actual fuck? I haven't. This is my one time. It's his longest play. The protagonist learns in Act One what happened. The ghost of his dead father says, revenge me. And yet Hamlet spends the remaining acts talking about, first of all, the philosophy of, oh, okay. And you mentioned, Jen, at the start of the podcast, you know, why should Hamlet murder, right? I mean, so, you know, as if it were an ethical, or religious issue for Hamlet. And you know, the thing is, yeah, in a way it is, of course, because, you know, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. But that's not what's keeping him from...
What's keeping him?
Well, I argued at the end of the book that he would prefer not to.
I was thinking about how...
brings us to Bartleby.
I was thinking of the psychology. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Linda. Go.
No. You were thinking about the psychology of procrastination.
Or the way you talk to children. In other words, we've learned that you don't say to a child, would you like to, or you don't say, you don't ask a child, you know, would you like to leave now? Or are you done playing? You say, it's time to go. And I don't think the ghost says it's time to kill. It's kind of like, it's a more of a question, like, are you going to do this or not? Or maybe, or was it a command? Did his father give him a command? Or
it's interesting the way that it's phrased. That's a great question. The ghost says, oh, Hamlet, if, and I don't have it in front of me, so a few words will be off. I don't have anything in front of me. If ever thou didst thy dear father love, and Hamlet says, oh, God. The ghost says, and revenge his murder. And Hamlet says, murder? And the ghost says, murder most foul, as in the best it is, but this most foul and unnatural. Okay, so something very close to that. If the ghost, if ever anyone had a mandate delivered from beyond the grave, you don't need to look for that passage.
I have it now.
I'm so used to to like Zoom teenying with you and just, you know, having conversations. I can see
you got it exactly right, though. I'm impressed.
I did. How many? Wow. Yeah. This is like this is.
There's
a
strange in there. It's murder most foul, as in the best it is, but the most foul, strange, and unnatural.
Oh, okay. I forgot strange. Yeah. I mean, basically, if ever I need a bone marrow transplant, they're going to have to find Shakespeare because that's what my bone marrow is. But I left out that word. I think that this issue of, I mean, let's think about what this means. Can we talk about what this means for now?
Yes.
Because, you know, this... You were gracious enough to put me on what's now being called the famous spreadsheet. But when you were first, you know, talking about a podcast, we spoke about this, and I'm really grateful to be on the first spreadsheet. I think that for me, the things that I wrote back, you know, a decade ago. And, you know, I've continued to publish on Shakespeare and contemporary political psychology because that's how I do it. For me, that's how I do it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something that will snag me. Oh, and I wanted to tell you about just if we can talk about writing process again for a second. Do we have any time?
We have plenty of time because I've got a couple more things too I really want to ask you about.
Okay. Okay, great. For my first book, Notorious Identity, one of the things that authors struggle with, as you know.
I know you were going to say something, but I want to cut you off because I want to move you somewhere else for a second before you go back to where you were, which is what I'm thinking is for most of us who engage, or at least as an English major, and then maybe others who don't realize this is happening to them as they're being taught Hamlet. There are two different branches. One is to situate this play in the Western literary tradition, beginning with like the Epic of Gilgamesh, moving to the Odyssey with the whole Telemachia piece to that. Then we have Hamlet. Maybe you get some Leopold Bloom from Ulysses, and maybe even today in Hamilton. But this idea that it's kind of taught, you know, in the Jungian hero's journey. That's one branch. The other branch is this is all Oedipus. And like we haven't even talked about Hamlet's relationship with his mother and his issues with women, but those, it seems like treating this as here is this artifact from the Western literary tradition, and you must know about it just because you won't understand any modern literature if you don't understand Hamlet, the hero's journey. And then we have the other, which is this is all Freud. And yet we have spent our time much more interested in the political story, which brings me to what I think is the most incredible insight about how over the years the political agenda of Hamlet has been downplayed. You write about this in your book, and that this is the fault of stage as well as film productions who sometimes excise from the play anything about the political agenda. I'm just like blown away by this and wonder why that's the case, why we miss that.
These are what you've just asked me, Jen, is brilliant. And
I love when you, this is why we're such good friends, because no matter what I say, you say that. And I know having taken a class with you, you do the same with your students. This is what makes you an incredible professor, because you make people feel smart.
No, I use the word brilliant intermittently, and I never use it when I don't mean it. And the way that you've just put your question, I was not expecting this, and yet you're exactly right. I mean, I write against the Oedipal, the way in which the 20th century Oedipalized Shakespeare's Hamlet. Uh-huh. I write against the way in which the fact that the entire state of Denmark dies, is absorbed into Norway at the end of the play, is ignored in film productions, in, you know, everything is kind of cast aside for this tight little steamy Oedipalized triangle. And I'll return to that. What interests me more, okay, because this was a two-part question. I've got one and two. I wrote down as you were talking. The first was that Hamlet is situated in the literary tradition of the Bildungsroman, right? The and it's sometimes it's the hero's journey, but often it's...
I never thought about it as the coming-of-age novel. I never thought about that, but yeah. Good point.
The coming-of-age novel, the education of the young man, I mean, Stendhal.
Son,
the,
father, you know, yeah. Oh, interesting. Right. Yeah, I didn't...
So the Bildungsroman, right? The kind of education of the young man, the coming of age, going out and having experiences in the world. In the 18th century, that becomes really the dominant motif. Prior to that, nobody gives a flying fuck about the educative journey of some nobody. So it's a hero's journey or it's a villain's journey. So when Shakespeare's right, let me say that again more clearly.
Yeah.
The idea of the Bildungsroman, the romance, which simply means the kind of narrative over time and involving lots of travel and learning and, you know, separations and reunions, that process for the young man is a process that leads into what we call the romantic literature period. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, and Defoe and even for female characters, but almost always written by men, but, you know, Moll Flanders. Yeah. It's a Bildungsroman of sorts. But what I want to do is I want to kind of separate the 18th century literary tradition a bit from what comes before. So how does Hamlet, you know, how do we situate Hamlet in a tradition that includes, you know, Dante's Pilgrim, right? Being guided by Virgil down into hell. Right? I mean, Dante's Pilgrim.
Right.
You know, how do we separate the education of the ordinary person from, you know, some sort of special epiphany for the chosen ones? And Hamlet, I think in a way, first of all, I, as you know, having read the book, I completely reject any Oedipalized reading of Hamlet. I just think it's far too easy. It excludes far too much. And, I think that it, Laurence Olivier and whoever directed him, that movie really kind of nailed that in for the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it's wrong. But in Mel Gibson's version, in Zeffirelli's version, that right. was also there. Right? In Zeffirelli, that Oedipalized
narrative.
And
Kenneth Branagh's version, too, right?
In Branagh's version, yeah, except Branagh didn't. He didn't occlude Fortinbras.
Oh, good. Okay. Good point.
And so what I would say is... What's wrong with Branagh's version, and it's, you know, it's 4 hours, and the play is performed is about 4 hours. But what Branagh does is not so much the liberty that he takes is not by not Oedipalizing the relationship between Hamlet and his mother, but giving a backstory of Hamlet and Ophelia as having had sex.
That's surprising.
It's preposterous.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have Branagh's, you know, Shakespeare's Hamlet. And I love the way that it ends because, as you know, about the obscene father, and we need to leave a little bit of room to talk about that. The ending of Branagh's movie is the pulling down of the statue of old King Hamlet by the new king, young Fortinbras.
Hmm.
Pulling that down, which of course echoes the pulling down of Lenin's statue.
Saddam.
Saddam, I mean, the pulling down of statues. So much that Branagh gets right, but he can't resist having a backstory in which Hamlet and Ophelia have had sex. And that's just, you know, I mean, now, I'm not a Shakespeare purist. You know, people can do what they want to do. But if we're talking about the actual play, we're talking about the play.
So before we wrap things up, I want to think about, to the extent that part of your project has always been reading Shakespeare for the present, I'm wondering if you and I had an opportunity to recast or rewrite Hamlet or think about a current political figure as Hamlet, who is the Hamlet of our day? I mean, I have a view. You won't be surprised.
No, you have an idea. Okay. No,
that was a question. I mean, I just think Merrick Garland is our Hamlet.
That's good. What popped into my head, Merrick Garland. Oh my, Jen. Yes, of course. There's a reason we're friends. He popped into my head, and what gave me pause, though, I didn't come right out of the gate, was that I'm not, you know, having written so much about this, I would want to think really hard about it, because mm-hmm. I think that, you know, we are a culture in law that talks so much about intention. Mm-hmm. And so the fact of designating something as a crime, we get hung up again and again and again. Did this person mean to be committing a crime?
Right.
And so this fetishizing of intention versus the actual fact of things that were done. And this is where, you know, I mean, for the last five years.
My God, we could collaborate on this, because this is obviously huge.
We could, because the last 5 years I've been working on, you know, critical legal theory. So, you know, the fallacy of an assessment of criminality on intention. This really, really aggravates me. I mean, you know, one of the things that we know at this point and is obvious to everyone, and I'm keeping in mind what you asked about a modern Hamlet. And, you know, what came to your mind was Garland, and what came to my mind was Garland. But what I'm thinking about is larger, and not just the DOJ, but also neither you nor I have any doubt that the only thing that has kept the charges from being forthcoming is a paranoia about how the metric of politicization will be, will be seen. And that's So instead of saying, oh, we're worried about being seen as partisan, it comes down again and again to, well, did he know it was criminal? If I shoot somebody and say, I didn't know I was doing anything wrong, does that get me off the hook? Of course not. And so this, what is currently delaying, and I'm going to try to frame this terms of Hamlet to help us wrap this up, the sense of justice, clearly in Hamlet, the play Hamlet, the revenger's ethos is inadequate. Mm-hmm. It's not only inadequate, it's unjust. You know, you find out, okay, he killed... Oh, the last action hero. That's the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. You killed my father. Okay, you killed my father. I'm going to kill you. And then, of course, the Princess Bride, right? My name is...
God, that's so good. Now I know I have so many movies I want to immediately watch. Okay.
So the revenger's ethos. But, you know, the problem is that talionic law, it's fabulous. Our culture loves it. For our fictions.
What is that word?
Talionic.
Yeah, I've never heard it.
It's the root of retaliation. So talionic law is Old Testament law. For an eye. Okay, so talionic talionic law, it's the root of the word retaliation. Talionic law is what makes the concept of revenge so emotionally satisfying that you can inflict a punishment that will be like the crime and will have the same emotional and affective resonance. Well, our legal system, our entire legal system, is designed to foreclose talionic.
Yes.
And so what do we do when we have a system that won't allow for talionic law? Because the system has all kinds of mitigating factors.
Well, the classy way, the way you're supposed to say it is that, you know, that vengeance isn't a justifiable reason for punishment, but there can be the expressive value. You know, there are these different ways that we try to get at it. And I find it frustrating because we're supposed to say it's about, individualized deterrence, general deterrence, rehabilitation, and all this stuff, but we're supposed to frown upon and discourage vengeance as if it's some sort of primal, unjustifiable reaction to harm.
Yes, and let me suggest something to you before we, because I realize that we're getting ready to close, but let me suggest something to you given what you just said.
Okay.
That our legal system is all about the denial of the talionic impulse.
That's below the floorboards.
That's it. We're back to the Gothic. Oh my God.
Sorry. Go ahead.
No. This is fabulous.
You off though, but you said our whole legal system is designed to deny the talionic. Okay.
Yes, to deny the talionic impulse, but our entire popular and mass culture is about indulging the talionic.
Holy shit. So these things are in tension with one another, kind of like Catholicism and sex.
They're flip sides of the same coin.
Yes.
So the law is about the denial of the talionic impulse, but the cultural imaginary.
Right. So law comes in and says, we're the rational social order. We will replace the violence, the anger, the disorder. And yet
popular culture
indulges it because we need it deep in our souls to see it expressed even.
And not only do we need it, in some ways, integral relationship with each other. You and I are both against the death penalty. And
yes.
So, you know, let nobody misunderstand what's being said here. However, we're talking about, you know, a book about Hamlet and, you know,
punishment doesn't have to be incarceration. It could be taking all their wealth away. That's not another thing which we, right. I mean,
there's
we're not
so
talking
many different
about
kinds
yes.
of punishment. Right.
Right.
But what the image of law, of the law,
right,
is about disavowing the talionic impulse, denying it, denying that there could be any pleasure, deep, dark pleasure.
This is
right. It's like what I was writing about the Obscene Father in Dismember Me in that chapter, that the law is all about there's no affect we have here. But then our mass culture is all about the affect. It's all about the feels with a Z.
Got it. And, this is so good. Okay,
well,
is there anything, before we actually finally close, is there anything, you know, that I have left out that you feel like
No, except we need another, 100 hours to talk about this.
I feel like I need to take another class with you. I can't get enough.
No, but you're right. But we're right there in sync. These were my impulses behind writing Hamlet's Errors. Was about this disavowal between law and this other impulse, which, you know, and I'll leave it up to, you know, the auditor to decide which one is contaminating which.
And then we get back to blood. Bloodlines, and then, you know, under supported by blood violence and the vampire impulse. There we go.
The gothic, we should at some point write something together about about literature and the gothic. So thank you
law
so
literature,
much.
Law, literature, and the gothic. Let's do it.
Law, literature, and the gothic.
Okay. Let's make a date of that, Linda. It's so great talking with you.
You got it. You too. You too, Jen. And thank you so much for having me on with your other illustrious guests this first season, this first run.
There are so many more things that Linda and I could have talked about. One thing I didn't get to speak with Linda about was the many moments of prescience in her book, Hamlet's Heirs. Though she wrote it in around 2001 to 2003, it was ultimately published in 2006. And she spoke about the pseudo-equivalencies. When watching the news, you would hear someone present on the very tragic bombings in London in July 2005, right alongside a news story about how much money a particular movie grossed at the box office or a celebrity who had the flu. And this was written even before we were swamped by social media with all of these pseudo-equivalencies. And here's what she wrote, which could be still true today. In a culture in which all kinds of information are presented simultaneously as if they were equally noteworthy, the critical ability to differentiate between what is worthy paying attention to and what is not gradually eroded, and the ability to assess the credibility of certain claims is hobbled. She was seeing that then, and, you know, even more so now. There was something else she talked about, variety of concepts, and one of them I really liked was this notion of what she called enlightened false consciousness. I had never heard that phrase, enlightened false consciousness, but it certainly fits me and many people I know like a glove. And here's what she said. Unlike the old Marxian notion of false consciousness, in which underlings are duped into thinking that those they labor under have their best interests at heart, enlightened false consciousness involves knowingly choosing to adhere to an ideological fantasy out of a resigned conviction of its inevitable triumph. I think that's kind of where we are now. So thanks so much for listening. And please remember to follow Booked Up with Jen Taub on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And write to us by email at bookedup@politicon.com or send us a letter by mail to Booked Up, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. See you next week.